Water Committee, May 13th through, May 13th, May 23rd.
May 25.
You got the wrong stuff in front of me here, Sandy. May 25, 2005. It'd be better if it was May 13th. We'd have a better chance of getting out of here when I need to be out of here. We are in session, and we are prepared to open a work session on Senate Bill 579A.
Chair.
And Representative Alton.
You ready for motion?
I am.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 579A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Alto moves Senate Bill 579A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions or discussion? Is there any objections? Would we call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
He's excused.
Representative Dalto?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Excused.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crummel?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Senate Bill 579, having received the constitutional majority, is passed and will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And in light of the fact that this is Representative Barnhart's counter bill, would you like to do the honors?
Thank you, sir.
Okay, so ordered. I guess counter bill is a way to refer to it accurately. Is that?
Well, I put in an identical bill on the House side.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on down the line then to open. We'll close the work session on 579A and open a work session on Senate Bill 848A.
Mr. Chair?
Sandy.
Oh.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what you have before you are the A-A3 amendments.
Mm-hmm.
The amendments address a concern that was raised on Monday as far as the language including Clackamas County. The amendments narrow the language that we reviewed in the A-2s. The A-3s clearly just allow the bill pertaining to Washington and Clackamas counties only.
Okay.
Chair, I move the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 848.
Representative Aldo moves the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 848A. Representative Aldo moves the -A3 amendments to Senate Bill 848. And is there questions, discussion?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I believe that the A3 takes care of the issue that was raised, not necessarily on the record on Monday, and if it doesn't, then we ought to fix it. Oh, I guess there isn't a fixing it on the Senate side, is there? This is the fix.
Well.
But I think that this does take care, because it clearly makes this pertain only to Washington and Clackamas counties, which are actually the only two counties in the state that need to have this kind of authority anyway.
Yes, there was a concern brought to the chair on Monday regarding the kind of sweeping nature of the bill as amended with what the A2 amendments or the A1 amendments, where it included the entire state, and there were concerns. And then additionally, I am informed that Washington and Clackamas County are the only two county areas in the state that could possibly take advantage of what Senate Bill 848 entails, so it didn't seem like an unreasonable amendment, and appreciate you for putting the amendment in, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity.
Are there questions on the amendment, discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing no objections, so ordered, and a Motion on the bill would be in order.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 848 as amended by the A3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves House Bill 848 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Delto?
Aye.
Representative Tomei? Excuse. Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crummell?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Senate Bill 848A is declared passed, having a constitutional majority. Is this something you wanted to carry, Representative Crummell, or did you...
Well, I certainly could carry it, Mr. Chair, but I'm wondering, do all members of the committee have to be here in order for it to go to consent?
No, it doesn't have to.
Is this something that we ought to put to consent calendar?
Representative Dingfelder,
sure.
That's...
Sure. Sure. I think that would be fine.
No, no.
Okay.
I'll make a motion that the Senate Bill 848A is amended with the dash 3 amendments be referred to the consent calendar.
Representative Dingfelder moves that we refer 848A to the Ding... this is not a good afternoon. To the consent calendar. Is there objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
I don't mind it being moved to the Dingfelder calendar. Explain to me.
Have we passed that down? With that, we would close the... work session on Senate Bill 848.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
With your permission, I'd like to make a motion to allow Representative Brown to vote on Senate Bill 579 if he wants to.
Representative Dingfelder has moved. Is there any objection to allowing Representative Brown to vote on 579? Representative Brown, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you, Representative Brown.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Dingfelder. New York, so.
I know, it's pretty
easily
confused.
I mean, how could I possibly not, you know, put that into...
We're both from New York, so.
Both from New York, yeah. I mean...
What more can you say?
I mean, that should be sufficient. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Let's go on.
In case that's not confusing enough, there are actually three of us from New York.
Well, that's right.
That's why it's called the Empire State.
Yeah, but you're
this committee. That's why we know so much about water.
For a moment of silence. We're back in order. All right. With that, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 940A. And Sandy, please.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee should have Senate Bill 940-A2 amendments in front of you. You will recall the discussion again from Monday. Representative Barnhart expressed a concern about expanding the redemption days from 90 to 80. And then also currently in the bill, they've laid out the redemption judgment process. All this is doing is making reference to the existing statutory redemption language, refining it slightly.
Representative Barnhart.
You ready for a motion?
I am.
Remove the dash twos.
Representative Barnhart moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 948A.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. As we looked at this after the committee meeting last week, or I guess it was Monday. Feels like a lot longer ago than that. a couple of new pieces of information came up. One is that ORS 18.582 sub 2 will work just fine for the purposes that we're trying to use this for, because it would make this statute conform to the general statute on redemption. The other thing we learned was that the general statute on redemption might face revision to modernize the language. I still think that this is fine, because this would simply include the modernized language in this law and makes it far less complicated for the sheriff to figure out what he's supposed to do.
And the chair would like to thank Representative Barnhart for his work on this, and the chair would also like to note that it is one advantage of not having bills necessarily just go through judiciary when there are other committees that pick up on very, I think, important points equally as well. So we have the motion on the floor for the two amendments. Is there any discussion on those or further discussion? Is there any objections to the -2 amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Would entertain a motion. Representative Barnhart.
This doesn't have a further referral, does it? No. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 940A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves Senate Bill 940A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Objections. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Dalto?
Aye.
Representative Pomé, excuse. Vice Chair Dinkelman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kremel?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Having received constitutional majority, Senate Bill 940A as amended is passed, and I know you'd like to carry this, Representative, but I'd still entertain a consent calendar.
Well, that was what I was planning to do, is move it. We place on a consent calendar.
Representative Barnhart suggests we place this on the moves. We place this on the consent calendar. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So ordered. With that, we will go on and close the work session and on Senate Bill 940A as amended, and open a work session on Senate Bill 594. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 594.
It's like, I want to smell what's in there.
If it's contagious, can I leave now? It's going to be a long afternoon.
Senate Bill 594 had a public hearing last week. As you recall, this is a reciprocity bill for the fish and or shellfish from the Columbia River, either on the Oregon or the Washington side, to take fish or shellfish from any portion of the Columbia River. This has no revenue impact or fiscal impact statement, and there are no amendments on the bill.
And, colleagues, you will recall that we had some concern and discussion when this was being talked about, discussed in the public hearing. A discussion had to do with the whole issue of reciprocity and with the issue of the difference in bag limits between the states of Washington and the state of Oregon. The department came in and explained this to me, and I see they're in the audience, and I'd like to have them come forward if they would, please, and share with you, the committee, the same information that they provided me, which is the reason that I did not propose amendments for this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Russ Stoff, legislative liaison for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And with me today is Kurt Melcher, who's the Ocean Salmon and Columbia River Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, the issue that we spoke with you about, Mr. Chair, was differences in bag limits where Washington, and this question came up in work session or in public hearing last week. Washington recently combined a game division and a fish division that were separate agencies into one agency. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife did the same in the early 1970s. When they were separate fish commission and game commission in Washington, they had separate bag limits for salmon under the Fish Commission and a separate bag limit for steelhead under the Game Division. And those were two fish each per day. Now that they've combined, they still have that bag limit of two steelhead and two salmon per day for a total of four fish on the Washington side. In Oregon, we had the same artifact of a bag limit when we combined our Fish Commission and our Game Commission in 1974. We would hope that over time Washington may change their bag limit to resemble ours like they have on sturgeon, However, the issue that we explained were that in fact, salmon and steelhead generally aren't in the Columbia River in large numbers at the same time, and steelhead aren't captured in large numbers in the Columbia River. So, in fact, in practice, on the Washington side, it's rare for an angler to catch even two fish, and very rare for them to catch more than two fish as part of their daily bag limit. So, in practice, we don't see Washington anglers catching four fish and Oregon anglers being limited to two fish.
And is the department going to monitor this issue over, if this bill is to become law over the next few years, to ensure that the committee's concern about some kind of preferential treatment as far as the Washington anglers versus the Oregon anglers are concerned?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer the question to Kurt Melcher to describe some of our creel survey and angler survey programs on the Columbia River.
Thanks, Russ. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do, in fact, have extensive creel...
For the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Ocean Salmon and Columbia River Fishery Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We do have on the Columbia River extensive creel census programs, and we do, in fact, as we discussed earlier this week, monitor these fisheries very closely and directly with interviews of anglers dockside as well as on the river while they're fishing. We certainly keep track of instances where anglers have, for instance, exceeded our bag limit when they land in Oregon. We have the full capability to describe in detail any differences in terms of anglers utilizing or actually harvesting more fish than the Oregon bag limit. I think in my career when I was in the field, I do not recall ever checking an angler that had in excess of the Oregon bag limit and was deferring to Washington's regulations. I've checked with our local field staff as well as some of the local Oregon State Police officers, and it is a very infrequent occurrence. Some additional background. On the lower Columbia River, where we have approximately 200,000 angler trips, those would be days spent fishing annually for salmon or steelhead. The annual steelhead harvest is about 5,000 fish. That's 5,000 fish for 200,000 angler days. It's not very common that an angler actually catches two. Thank you.
Are there any questions then?
No, Mr. Chair.
The members, the chair is reasonably satisfied that the department will take their duty of ensuring Oregon anglers have basically a equal standing as far as takes of fish on the Columbia River seriously, and as such we would, if it's the committee's pleasure, the chair would be happy to move this bill forward.
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion? We're in work session, correct? Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves Senate Bill 594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objections?
No.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative
Dalto? Excuse.
Representative Tomei, excused. Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crowell?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Having received a constitutional majority, Senate Bill 594 is declared passed, and we'd entertain a consent calendar.
Mr. Chair? I would move Senate Bill 594 to the consent calendar on the floor.
Representative Crummell moves Senate Bill 594 to the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Hearing no objections, so ordered. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 594 and open a work session on Senate Bill 696. And I believe, yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 696, we had a public hearing on May 11th. As you recall, this allows the Board of Directors of Irrigation Districts to deny petitions for exclusion under certain circumstances. It declares an emergency effective upon passage. At this time, we have no amendments on the bill, and there's no fiscal or revenue or subsequent referral.
Mr. Jillian from my office is here. We've been looking at trying to resolve some of the conflict that appears to exist. Sean, do you have copies of the proposed rough draft amendment?
They are apparently sitting on the desk of Sandy. I do have one copy with me for myself if you want to run out and make copies.
We'll stand at ease for a minute here while we're waiting for copies of... in session, and momentarily we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 696 and entertain a motion from Representative Plummer.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Dalto to vote on Senate Bill 594.
Representative Carmel moves that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Dalto to vote on Senate Bill 594. Are there any objections? If not, so ordered. Representative Dalto, how do you vote?
Votes aye.
Representative Dalto votes aye on Senate Bill 594, and with that we'll close that and open our work session on Senate Bill 696. And Jillian, would you please tell us the nature of the amendments and explain that to us? You might also attempt to explain to us the concerns that have brought us to proposing the possibility of these amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Jillians, attorney from Portland, legislative aide to Representative Bob Jensen. As you may recall from the last public hearing on Senate Bill 696, Water for Life and I believe the Cattlemen's Association had some concerns about the bill. Water for Life submitted a brief to us explaining their concerns, and again, it was somewhat related to the ownership issue and who controls a water right. The primary contention of Water for Life's objections, and perhaps Mr. Kosestan will elaborate further if I don't do a good job of explaining it, but my understanding, his primary contention was that if districts deny this petition and the land is still inside the irrigation district, there was a possibility that a district could make a determination that the land was no longer susceptible of irrigation or no longer being irrigated, which in turn could run the 5-year statute, which in turn could either have forfeiture implications or also transfer implications for the landowner. In order to best address that, we started to draft these proposed amendments that you see in front of you. The information that's in bold is what's currently in the bill already. If it's underlined, that's actually the new language. So going through it, it would be Section 1 sub C would be the primary area. And we added in the will no longer receive district services to further clarify that this patron is in fact no longer receiving water from the district. Then the second part is saying that if the district decides to deny this petition, they cannot make that determination that the lands are no longer susceptible of irrigation. And by doing that, they can therefore not petition to the Water Resources Department for transfer of this water right that should be appurtenant to the land. And I did have a conversation before I came up here with Brendan about this. He seemed to think that that was already covered in the bill the way it's drafted now, but that he also thought this language was acceptable as far as further clarifying the issue so that we didn't get dragged into further ownership debate.
Okay. Are there questions for Sean? Representative Alcoff.
Just a question for the chair. Has this amendment been distributed to all the interested parties?
It has been effective as of today, when we came into session, Representative. The reason, A, it's in this format rather than LC format, is we have been spending spare time getting it in place and did not do that. Didn't get there until after the floor session this morning, so it was not, there wasn't time to go to LC with it, therefore not time to get it to the parties, and therefore the reason for the chair's decision to hold it over till Monday, because to give everybody the opportunity as well as the committee the opportunity to see these amendments and to, if you wish, meditate on them or ask questions about them.
Will we be meditating on Memorial Day or
till Wednesday?
That'd be a good time on Wednesday. Till Wednesday, you can meditate on Memorial Day. Well, that's fine.
Thank you very much.
I will meditate on them as I'm going around the golf course in Coeur d'Alene.
That's yeah, right. I know. This is a these are three iron meditations. I was going to get medications in there.
Medication might not be a bad idea.
We may need medication.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It appears, to me anyway, that this does make, that this language does make it very explicit from a standpoint of the issue of administrative convenience and what the district can and can't allow and that sort of thing. I mean, that's,
the chair is not always inclined to agree with legislative counsel, but that's what we pay them for, to get their advice. And at least in this case, the chair is in agreement with legislative counsel that we think the bill kind of already does this. And they're not real sure that it's necessary, but if it will relieve heartburn and make people happy, we're willing to go there, sort of thing. So, with that, thanks, Sean. I appreciate your time and effort on this, and he has been earning more than his salary from me in the last 2 days with the flood of amendments and issues that have come into the office, and we do genuinely appreciate that and what he's doing. And I would at this point, I see that Mr. Myers has asked to speak on this bill, and I would invite you, Doug, if you want to have some comments for us on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Doug Myers, representing Water Watch. I was prepared, I was not prepared, in fact I must have been asleep on May the 11th when the hearing was held, but I now have written testimony which I'm not going to turn in because it's possible that Water Watch could have a misunderstanding of irrigation district water law, and so I want the Water Watch attorney in Medford, Bob Hunter, to talk with representatives from the Water Resources Congress, and maybe it can be resolved. So with that, I just express a possible concern, but hopefully it will be resolved.
What was it on May 11th? Was that the day you said you were asleep?
Mr. Chairman.
You realize that that deeply hurts the chair. Not so much that you were asleep, but that you were asleep on the day of his birthday.
Oh, that's right. That's probably why I didn't realize this bill was up and what was happening. I got caught up
meditating.
In excitement.
He was medicated.
Meditating and medicated.
Thank you, Doug. We're having far too much fun today.
Oh, boy.
Let's put a stop to that fun we're having and bring up Mr. Kosasan and his legal counsel if he wishes to have advice. Okay.
What?
Oh. I am advised by members of my panel here that the fund probably is just starting on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosasan, Water for Life. The proposed amendment, I don't believe, gets to some of the underlying issues. And I apologize. Basically, when this measure was before the Senate, I missed it entirely. And that's why we are raising concerns on the House side as opposed to the Senate side. But if you look at, I think, quote, the proponents' purported purpose of the measure, they have indicated that there are costs associated with remapping in the event someone wants to be excluded. And if you look at the requirements in 545-109, requirements of a district in terms of following up for purposes of a patron being excluded. When the Board of Directors excludes any lands from the district upon petition, if the exclusion changes the boundaries of the district, the Board shall make an entry in its minutes describing the boundaries of the district. For that purpose, the Board may have a survey made of such portions of the district as it considers necessary. A certified copy of the entry of the minutes of the Board excluding any land certified by the Secretary of the Board shall be filed for record in the County Clerk's Office of each county within which any land of the district is situated. Not very onerous. Coupled with the fact that if a patron wants to be excluded, and it should be noted, the Board currently does not have the ability to accept or simply deny a petition. They accept it and they grant it. But in terms of exclusion, if one were to look at 545-099, the Board, as a condition of exclusion, may require the petitioners to pay all costs of exclusion, including but not limited to recording fees, a reasonable administrative fee, and all past due charges and assessments of the district attributable to the petitioners and the lands of the petitioners. The long and short of it, it is not an obligation of the Board or the district, but by the patron himself. I don't think that would represent an onerous requirement on the part of a district. I think this situation, to a great degree, stems from a situation in one district in state currently, and it is a pending situation. It's my understanding the patron requested to be excluded from the district boundaries. The district rejected the petition for exclusion. Again, 545-099. Upon receipt of a petition for exclusion, the Board of Directors shall review the petition and shall enter its order approving the petition. I think the law is fairly clear on its face, and I don't think there's a lot of room for discussion with that. Aside from that, Mr. Chair, our concerns, again, deal with this ownership debate. And let me reference the situation once again. a patron wanted to be excluded. His petition to the district, it's my understanding, was denied. And I think that the district was acting erroneously or counter to current statutory provisions. That's one set of situations. I think the other set of situation arising is that the individual patron desired to cancel his right and petition the Water Resources Department to do just that. That petition was granted, and within a very short time, it was later, the department informed the patron that their motion approving the cancellation was withdrawn. Coupled with this, you had a situation, I believe, and from what is documented, the Bureau of Reclamation was indicating that the patron himself did not have the ability to cancel his right. I think this gets to the point very clearly of ownership. I think it's a rather interesting bill, but I think our concern is that long term, this direction will indeed confuse the issue of ownership, and I think it will be problematic down the road. For that, Mr. Chair, we would encourage the committee to look at further amendments clarifying, and I think what was presented was a strong start, but I think we need to be a little bit more clear in terms of, in the event language is included, for a board to deny a petition for exclusion, I think the situation needs to be further clarified to suggest that long-term, a district board will not exercise management control over that water right attached to the pertinent property. I think proponents of the legislation have indicated that this is not the case because the underlying water right would no longer be there when a petition for exclusion was originally forwarded to the board. And again, by using this immediate example, we can find that that's not the case. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. I appreciate the Chair's willingness to look at clarifying amendments, and we'd be happy to continue to work on this.
Any questions?
Representative Crowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to figure out, because obviously I'm not an attorney, nor do I want to, well, I don't know, I mean, anyway, that it appears, though, that the proposed language does make it pretty explicit, because on one side, the proponents of the bill are saying that person in this kind of a situation before the administrative convenience, the patron is no longer going to be receiving any kind of benefits from the district, and on the other hand, the issue that was that's been raised, I think, by Water for Life for the issue around what happens with the water right it's no longer being irrigated, but also not being susceptible to no longer susceptible to irrigation. Doesn't that then get at the issue with regards to that water right? So that if the owner of the right of the land is then saying they want the water to go back in stream for fish or I guess whatever the department sort of decides where it goes, doesn't this language make it pretty explicit from a standpoint that there is no water right with the appurtenant land? Or
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I don't believe so. In terms of language talking about the determination of a board, make a determination that the land petition to be excluded is no longer irrigated or no longer susceptible of irrigation. Specific language to that effect is found at 540-572. In terms of granting a district authority after a fourth year of non-use to petition for that water right subject to potential forfeiture after the fifth year. That results from legislation passed in 1991. I think it was House Bill 2191. And I think that's part of it. But the language here does not really get to the underlying issue that after the fifth year of non-use, for example, a right is subject to forfeiture. And if that is the case, it's kind of irrelevant whether you're talking about the fourth year or the fifth year. Without express language, I believe, to suggest that the underlying water right remains under the control of the landowner, or unless truly canceled or forfeited, the landowner retains that ownership, controlling, management ability for that right. I think this is very problematic long term, and I do not believe this language addresses that concern, Representative Carlo.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, so are you suggesting that additional language to make it explicit with regards to the water right itself staying with the property owner unless it is specifically canceled or has been forfeited?
Correct. And Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, again, I think language could be clarified or included, which would clarify that situation, that the landowner, the water right, remains appurtenant to the land, and the landowner is the one with the ultimate control or ability to control that right. Absent of that, I think what you're going to do is have a situation, I think, similar to the one that has arisen with this example that I have been using, where the district wants to try to retain that right, move the right, and now we have a situation, I believe, where the Bureau of Reclamation has made overtures that they should have some type of ownership interest in that right. I think we're losing the discussion in terms of who ultimately controls that right. I believe it's the landowner.
But if I may, Mr. Chair, and I didn't go get the statute to get right in front of me, but in ORS 545, I believe, isn't it 140, that specifically lays out the issue regarding ownership the water right staying appurtenant to the land. This is not going to, with this explicit language in there, this is not going to then supersede that particular statute, is it? Is it 140?
I think your pertinency language, Representative Krummel, is found at 540, 510.
540.
And that is the initial provisions starting with the transfer of water rights.
Is that relevant? Does that have relevance in this case?
Mr. Chair, I believe it. Trying to respond to a question from Representative Krummel, I believe it does, in the sense that we have a situation, or I think you would experience situations where there are efforts to sever the water from the land, and it no longer would remain appurtenant. So I would argue that it would be very relevant.
But I guess, Mr. Chair, I believe he's right that it is in 540-510. My point is, is it your contention then that this would supersede the language in 540-510 so that a pertinency that's described there would not apply? I'm not sure I'm asking my question correctly, Mr. Chair, but I'm just trying to.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cromwell, I believe a very strong argument that with this proposed language, a district would contend that indeed that they could undertake efforts or initiate efforts to sever that right from the land and separating that water right, the underlying water right, no longer would be appurtenant to the land. Was that answer as convoluted as
my question?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I would agree. Never with it. This is as convoluted as my question.
Thank you.
Without really having any experience in this area, I don't know how a court would think that if it ever went to court, that the court would be looking at it from a standpoint of the, you know, what the appurtenancy statutes say, and then looking at this, if a water district were trying to use this particular statute, assuming this bill with the proposed amendment were to pass, that the court would then say that appurtenancy did not apply because of the way this statute is written. I mean, I don't know if they would or wouldn't, but I would think that they would, in sort of looking at the hierarchy of things, that they would go back to the 540-510. Now, that's just, I guess I'm sort of looking at it more from a layperson, you know, reasonable, kind of common sense sort of an approach. Not a legalistic sort of an approach. And maybe I'm sure the court, you know, courts could figure out a way to make me wrong.
Any but semblance of common sense, as far as the courts are concerned, is often questioned. Why don't we have a chance to see what the folks on the other side of the question have to say, and then we'll have a summation of that by legislative counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt with the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and with me is Anita Winkler, Executive Director of the Congress, and we're not exactly sure who's on first. I think Anita's on first. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Anita Winkler, Oregon Water Resources Congress. I wanted to try and explain a little bit about the...
Could I ask you to speak to the amendment first, the proposed, potential proposed
to the
amendment?
With the disclaimer that I'm not particularly good at thinking really fast on my feet, the initial blush is I think that this will be okay with our members. But I really do need a chance to go back and run it by a couple of people who find this whole topic near and dear to their hearts. But my first blush is that the amendment that your staff presented today, I think, will work.
Okay. Chair, I should give that same disclaimer when I get before mine.
Go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit, and I promise to be brief, about the particular situation which Mr. Kosasan referred to, about an irrigation district, the situation that may have given birth to some of this. The fact of the matter is it did not give birth to our bringing the bill forward. It simply added to the reason that we needed to bring it forward. But in that particular case, there is a water user who has developed his own source of water. He's developed a groundwater source, at which point he did apply to cancel his water right. and at the same time began conversations with the district board to exclude from the district. In looking, and I've got copies of a couple of the minutes of a couple of board meetings, and I don't know that this has been back in the last few weeks since I got those. I would think not, but I can't say that for sure. At that time, there were conversations based on a letter he submitted to the board. The board at that time asked him for some additional information to verify that he had an alternate source of water. At that, he had not submitted those yet, and nor had he turned in a formal petition meeting the requirements under the statute. So the conversation was going on. In the meantime, Water Resources Department did approve his request to voluntarily cancel his water right on one day, and the next day rescinded that approval because the Bureau of Reclamation let both the water user, the Irrigation District, and the Water Resources Department know that they would litigate over that cancellation because they, the Bureau, claim they have an interest in that water right. It's kind of another version, or it's kind of that next step of the ownership discussion, that the Bureau was claiming some ownership right in it. As a result of the Bureau's letter, the department said, well, wait a minute, what can we do to solve this without putting everybody in litigation and running up the bill? My understanding is at this point there are discussions about the Bureau helping work out a deal to transfer the water right to another piece of property within the district, which would relieve the person who was applying to cancel his water right and wishing to exclude from any relationship with the district. He would no longer need district services to get that water right. He would not have a water right that's part of the district's delivery system. And so he would no longer be subject to charges of the district. And my understanding is he has now said he will not pursue the exclusion because he's happy because he's not got any relationship with the district. Now, that's information as of about 3 weeks ago, and it may have changed. And I would be more than happy to double-check on that. But it's a little bit different in what happened, and then the Bureau had stepped in, stunning all of us, frankly. Nobody expected the Bureau to step in, but they did step in, and that's what triggered the change in that whole process. Having said that, we could probably spend hours debating merits of the whole other parts of this discussion. There's just some, I think Christina's going to try and explain what really happens by the time you get to an exclusion, and I think there's some real confusion about what it means and what has happened by the time you actually reach the point that that petition is being submitted, and maybe that'll help clarify why we're asking for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, for the record, Christina McNitt. Maybe I can kind of step through the process that a landowner would take in the relationship he or she has with the district prior to ever getting to a petition for exclusion. I think there's some confusion about what the processes are, and maybe even a sense out there that once you're an irrigation district patron in good standing, you're sort of a patron forever, and you can't leave that the company of the district. There is an ability for an irrigation district patron to basically sever his or her relationship with the irrigation district. He would typically maybe not need water anymore. Maybe they're developing property, or they've developed an alternative water source. They've drilled a well. Maybe they're fortunate enough to be near a live river source, and they can directly divert water right themselves. So in those cases, then that person would have no reason to continue to pay the fees and receive the services of an irrigation district, and they would no longer have an interest in the water that the irrigation district delivers to them. Good, bad, or ugly on the ownership issue, and I know, Mr. Chair, that you have tried vigilantly to keep that issue kind of on the sidelines as we continue to discuss how to resolve that. There are issues about the ownership interests of water rights, and what I'm hoping to explain to you today is that those issues reside in the transfer statutes, in forfeiture, in how you resolve that water right. But before the patron gets to the district to exclude, which is a process I'll go through in a minute, those issues have already been dealt with. Good, bad, or ugly. And this bill does not attempt to address those issues. What Senate Bill 696 attempts to do is simply give an irrigation district board of directors, a local government that's a taxing authority, the discretion to deny a petition for exclusion. If you think of an irrigation district as having exterior boundaries as a big, gigantic lima bean, imagine like a rural fire protection association. Not everybody inside the exterior boundaries of the fire protection district would have necessarily trees that they want to pay the fire protection district to protect. So a lot of people would be intermingled among the patrons there, and yet they don't receive the services, but they don't have the ability to exclude under special district statutes, which are found in Chapter 198 of ORS. Special districts are required to deny any petition for exclusion if the property inside the exterior boundaries is susceptible to the services. What we're trying to do is set up some discretion for irrigation districts to simply do the same thing. And we tried to put language in that would alleviate concerns by landowners so that they realize they're part of the bargain, is that they would be held harmless, they wouldn't be receiving the services, and they wouldn't be charged for them. And I think, Mr. Chair, that your staff has gotten a long way in providing some additional language maybe to assure landowners. That is simply our intent. It's an administrative process. It's not a process that involves water rights. We don't want it to be a process that brings in water rights, and would hope that you might consider the bill. We will meditate over it with or without medication over the Memorial weekend in hopes that we don't have to mediate anymore.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell. Thank you. Christina, you made an interesting comment, and that was that the water district, or excuse me, that the landowner would not have an interest in the water that the water district is providing. But what about the water district having an interest in the landowner's water right? Because it's the landowner's water right that gives the district the ability to deliver the water in the first place, because of a group of landowners coming together, sort of pooling their right and then saying we're going to only divert out of one place instead of out of 20 places or 40 places or 150 places. We're going to just divert out of one and then build the infrastructure, whether it be pipes or ditches or whatever, to then disperse the water from this one diversion point out to all of the landowners. So I think that's what one of the issues here is. So while yes, this bill would allow for the property owner to not have an interest and not be charged for the services and the benefits of being part of the water district, doesn't the water district still have they still would probably prefer to have an interest in you know, because if a person is allowed for, and I don't know for irrigation districts what kind of municipal, it's like, you know, like Wilsonville, for example, can divert 20 million gallons a day out of the Willamette River. And that's their water right. In irrigation, sort of a, you know, I don't know what the measurement is. If it's in cubic feet per second, or if it's in, acre feet, or millions of gallons. But my point is that doesn't the district then have an interest in the amount of water because of needing to be able to fill their pipes to deliver to other areas?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, Ms. Winkler would like to respond to that.
If Representative Jensen and Representative Crummell, at the time you get to the exclusion, the petition to exclude, the landowner has taken some action to change the nature of the water right in some fashion. They have either transferred it off of the land that's within the district, don't know where, and they may have transferred it to an in-stream use for fish. They may have transferred it to other land. They may have transferred it into some of the water banks that are going on around the state. I mean, there's a number of places they could have done with it, have transferred it. They may have made a change in a point of diversion, or they may have changed from a stream to groundwater. In all of those instances, they are no longer looking to the district for delivery, and the district has no interest in that water right. They have nor any ability to do anything about that water right. When you talk of, for instance, if the overall water right that the district is diverting is, say, 100 CFS, and I'm going to use round numbers so I can do the math easily, and that landowner had 5 CFS and has done something else with that water right, the district's diversion is then reduced to 95, 100 minus the 5. They cannot divert more water than they have water rights for delivery. So once a landowner has taken that water right and put it somewhere, done something else with it, it's no longer part of the district's delivery system. The district can no longer divert that water. It's gone as far as the district is concerned.
But then can't the district, if the if a property owner wants to keep the water right, or they're applying, or they've notified the department that they want to cancel the water right, and now and so the district's their diversional ability, or what they can legally divert, is reduced, say, by that 5 CFS, so it's down to 95. My point is that isn't it then really beneficial for the district, for the property owner, to maintain their water rights so that the district can continue to divert 100 CFS? Because, you know, how does anybody know that, for example, the water right owner is actually getting a full CFS per, you know, in terms of their actual usage, and whatever, although the water district can divert, so they can divert 100 cubic CFS, then if this person's not using their full 5, somebody else could be potentially picking up 1 or 2 CFS.
Chair Cromwell, if in the example you use, the landowner has canceled the water right, the district can't do anything about that right now. I mean, we would like to argue that in a whole different forum and have some discussions that maybe the district would like to be able to do something, but the way the law is right now, if I'm the landowner and I walk into Water Resources and say I want to cancel my 5 CFS and it's canceled, it is taken off of what the district can divert. It is gone, and the district can do nothing about it. If a landowner wants to exclude from the district, I can't figure out any way that they would want to exclude from the district while still holding on to a water right that requires district delivery services to get the water to the land, because it's a useless water right if they exclude from the district. You have this little island sitting there that doesn't get any district service because it's sitting on a water right, or holding a water right that's appurtenant to that land, but can't get the water delivered to them. So they have a whole different problem. And then they will have some forfeiture issues kicking in, but at that point, there's nothing anybody can do because he can't get the water. Once he's excluded, it's a complicated process to come back in an inclusion, and the district's not required to include somebody who petitions back. So it's pretty dangerous to do that. If you're going to exclude, and I go back to the process and what Christine referred to, all the activity relating to changing the water right, to doing something different with that water right, or protecting it however the landowner wants to do it, has to be completed before they come to exclude, or they're at risk of having a water right that they can't use and has no value at that point. Did I answer your question?
Well, I think so. Let me go to another question, if I may, and that is, sort of backing up, because one of the things that's been asserted by opponents of the bill is that, you know, the ability for the water district to recapture any expense, so really basically making the bill, you know, not needed. Kind of help me out with what, or help me understand where your answer is on that, because I see it right here. I mean, on line, what is it, 26, I guess, of the printed bill, it says if the petitioners propose to change the use of the land, oh, whoops, wrong place. Where is it? Starting on line 22, I'm sorry. The board, as a condition of exclusion, may require the petitioners to pay all costs of inclusion, exclusion, which would include and not limiting to recording fees, administrative fees, past due charges and assessments, district, I assume then that that would mean mapping and all of that kind of stuff. Now, if the, you know, if the person wants to be excluded and there's pipes going across their property and that sort of thing, then the district has to figure out a way to get an easement. And I don't know, maybe the costs end up sort of washing out. No pun intended. So with that sort of language in there, why, I don't understand why this is an issue for the districts.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, there are costs that we think couldn't be recaptured. A good number of them could, and possibly the mapping could. There's a cost. Many districts have, let's get the word wrong, they have divisions for purposes of elections that are based on land divisions and so on. All that has to be recalculated, because you've lost an amount of land, so you got to refigure all that. That's not inexpensive to do. The easements to which you referred would probably not be recapturable under this. They might be, but we don't know. If they are, and I talked to a couple districts, if you take all of the costs, they could range from $2,000 to $10,000, assuming the easements go through smoothly and they don't end up in all those other kinds of things. And frankly, I got to believe that if the district turned around and said to that landowner, you got to pay $10,000 to exclude, then somebody's going to yell that the district's beaten up on an individual, and that's unfair, and they're trying to prevent them from excluding by passing all the costs on, in which case we're caught between a rock and a hard place. We're kind of damned if we do and damned if we don't. $2,000 may not be an overall thing. Yeah, well, I spent way too many years in local government to not appreciate that, but I also, you know, when you can avoid it, it seems to make some sense, especially when the end result of denying a petition means that that landowner isn't subject to any more charges. Basically, they have everything that they've asked for. They just haven't had this little, I don't know whether to call it like a cookie cutter. I don't know exactly how to describe it. They haven't had this little piece carved out of the district for whatever reason it is that they want to carve it out. And we don't know why they necessarily want to carve that out. And I'm not trying to be disingenuous. I'm not trying to play any games. We truly believe that when you get that far and they're no longer subject to the charges of the district, and we don't argue that they should not be subject to the charges of the district if they're not getting service, we think that's appropriate. We can't quite figure out why people get so anxious to have the next step, other than there's some sort of, for lack of a better word, personality conflict between a landowner and the district. And I think that happens with any, as you well know, any member of a local government entity and the governing board of that local government.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Brendan, would you set all the records straight now? Thank you for coming up and listening in and enlightening us as to what we're hearing. Let me rephrase that. Thank you for helping us through this.
My pleasure. Well, I'm not exactly sure where to begin. First off, I did not draft this bill originally. Irrigation districts fall outside my normal subject area, but the interplay with water...
For the record, please.
Oh, sorry. Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. But because of the interplay between water rights and water ownership, the questions have been coming to me regarding this bill. So when it comes to actually trying to talk about irrigation district law, there may be some general areas that I'm a little unclear on. It's not one of the areas I normally draft in. I have read arguments of both proponents and the opponents on this bill. I have a difficult time envisioning situations coming to the fore where, because of this bill, there would be loss of control of the water right itself. It's not to say that I'm saying that there aren't but I do have a difficult time imagining those situations. They seem to be fairly extenuated. I mean, there's a if something happens, and if something else happens, and if something else happens, and if something else happens, then possibly there would be a situation where a water user would not be able to do this one thing. And I think, well, possibly that may be true. Beyond that, I don't have. I'm not exactly sure what you would like from me this afternoon.
Do you have any specific questions?
Well, I do, Mr. Chair. If it's all right, it's kind of going back to the same question that I posed to the opponents of the bill, and that is with this proposed language, and I sort of view it as being more explicit. But would a court, you know, in your experience and realm of knowledge, would a court hold this section up over, say, for example, ORS 540, what did we say it was, 510, that describes a pertinency and landowner water rights and that sort of thing? And so if the department has, under 540, 510, has issued a permit for X amount of water to be diverted by the property owner, and it's now part of this water district, but under 545.099, assuming this language were to pass and be signed, would a court say, well, because of this language here, the district has a right to the water right, and therefore doesn't have to exclude, or I'm not, and I realize that, you know, the way the issue is framed when it's taken into the court obviously is going to determine, but I'm sort of looking at this from a common sense kind of a standpoint, and I recognize judges don't necessarily have to use common sense, but you know, sort of when I read the appurtenancy language, I've learned a lot more about water law than I ever thought I would know, or care to know. But anyway, or would they hold them as two separate issues and say, okay, under the exclusion statute, you can be excluded, and this language is very explicit, and yes, they can deny for administrative convenience, and this is the way it is, and it does not damage your right to continue to hold the water right itself, and does not mean that you have to negate or give that water right up to the district, nor does the district have a right to that water right, and the amount that they can divert is actually reduced by Y amount.
Let's see if I can unravel that.
I think it's as convoluted as I asked Mr. Kosasan. I tried to make it as convoluted.
That's
right. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, I do view what's going on in this bill and the question of petitioning for exclusion from the irrigation district and the question of the control of the water right as being separate. The denial of a petition to exclude or the granting of a petition to exclude is somewhat independent, as you say, these two separate things from what's going on, what the result is on the water right that the landowner is using. In either case, I think the control realistically remains the same. If a landowner is using their water right, and they petition for exclusion, and the petition is granted, then the water district is not going to deliver water because it's delivery to outside of the district, then that point in time, the landowner, to avoid forfeiture, would probably petition for transfer of point of diversion or move to groundwater or some, you know, obtain their water in some other fashion. That amount would be removed from the irrigation district's right, and everyone would go forth and hopefully be happy. If the petition were denied, then the situation still exists that the landowner could petition for transfer, petition to change the point of diversion, and then again at some point in time petition the district to leave the district again, and would have control of their own water right again. That amount would be removed from what the irrigation district would be delivering. In the second case, and probably the first case as well, this is not a closed process. I don't see the irrigation district or the user as being ignorant of what the other party is doing. In both cases, there's a third party that enters into this whole fray, and that's the commission for determining whether the transfer should occur or not. I'm not sure, you know, what has been indicated to me that the concern is that there would be a situation where someone might be in the fourth year of non-use and then petition to leave, and if the petition were not granted and they reached that fifth year of non-use and the water right was forfeited, that it wouldn't go back in stream, it would go to the irrigation district for further for some other user in the district. I'm not sure where I come down on that argument that was just presented to me just a little while ago in the hearing room here. So the issue there seems to be an argument over the end result of what happens when water would be forfeited, whether it would go back in stream or go to the irrigation district. I don't know the firm answer on that. And in that case, there may be a difference. But in other situations, you know, I see the petition question as one question, the ownership question as another question, and ultimately the question of whether one party can do something or not do something and to transfer their water right being resolved by the third party in the commission. And it's as if some of the arguments flying around today seem to be as if there's no as if there is no process in place to deal with some of these issues, and there is. It's the transfer process.
Addition, Mr. Chair? If I may, excuse me. And that is sort of going back to the question that I asked with regard to the proponents with regards to the argument that's been made that, you know, this bill really isn't necessary because if it's a cost issue that the district is trying to get around, you know, the statute says that they can recoup their costs. Irrespective of what the costs are, and I understand the issue of being damned if you do and damned if you don't, because I've been there too, and even in this job find myself there many times. But the bottom line is that if, you know, I mean, if the district's not trying to make a profit, they're just covering their costs, and the costs are, you know, whether it's $2,000 or $10,000, it doesn't really matter. Those are the costs, and they can charge those to the person that's applying for exclusion. So from that perspective, is the bill even really necessary?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, of course, the question of whether the bill is really necessary or not is a little bit beyond my pay grade, but the current statute as I read it, and again, I'm not the expert on irrigation district law, current statute as I read it seems a little bit unusual in that if a petition is made, the statutory language says a petition shall be granted. And it does give the district the ability to condition that permit to comply with three separate statutes, many of which deal with sort of a sense that granting the permit would somehow impair obligations or impair the water district, the irrigation district itself. So if there was a situation where excluding this property would realistically result in the total elimination of the irrigation district, the petition, though it still says shall be granted in compliance with the statute that says exclusions can't impair the district. So I find that to be a very curious situation. I don't know what would be the result. How do you condition, if a petition would otherwise completely impair the district, how do you condition it so that it doesn't without, in effect, denying it?
So a de facto denial.
De facto denial. Now, and in that vein, I'm not sure why it's a bad idea to then say that there may be administrative situations where a district may deny a permit. As the proponents do point out, other special districts have that authority. And I'm not an expert on special districts either.
Friend?
Sir?
I think in the case of other special districts, that's not the authority they have. They have to deny it. The only way they can approve it, if I'm not mistaken on that statute. It seems like an apples and oranges, since one is going one direction, the other going another direction.
Well, Mr. Chair, certainly the districts are apples and oranges as far as the services that they provide and the types of things that they provide to the people within the district. The language does seem, and it's fairly odd also, just from a historic standpoint. I mean, this statute has been this way for an awfully long time. So I wonder just exactly how everyone's been managing all of this time without this language. From a reading of the statute, it does seem as though forcing a district to grant the permit, if somehow there would anyway be a de facto denial without just saying that they can deny it, seems to me to be a little bit odd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I see your able staff is here too.
It's the hook.
Yeah.
where's my hook?
Thank you, Brendan. I appreciate you taking the time. And with that, could I ask Adam to come up and enlighten me on a couple of things? Did you take a position on this for the first question?
For the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resource Department, and we did not take a position on this bill, Mr. Chair. I guess I would characterize it as we don't necessarily have a dog in this fight, although it seems like there's things that folks are arguing about.
We're having, perhaps, since, you know, some question about dogs and fighting dogs. Maybe it'd be better to refer to it a pony in this race.
We don't have a pony in this race, Mr. Chair, but I also, and I don't have a lot to add to the sort of legal analysis that Brendan provided the committee, but I would say that I agree that the department, you know, when this bill was heard on the Senate side, we viewed the process of exclusion and the process of transferring or, you know, severing the appurtenancy of a water right as separate issues. And we didn't see this bill in any way adversely affecting the state's ability, if you will, to manage water. And that was sort of what we described on the Senate side. And I just, in drilling just a tiny bit deeper into a question that Representative Crummell asked, and this may have been covered already, I just wanted to make it clear that the statutory authority under the district transfer statutes, where a district can actually initiate a water right transfer to change the appurtenancy of a water right. Under all of those statutory provisions, the owner of the land to which the water right is appurtenant must be a willing party in all of those district-type transfers. And so I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that provision. That again, when it's a district initiated transfer under the district transfer statutes, the landowner to which the water right is appurtenant is needs to be a willing participant.
One other issue I have a question or concern. What's the department's status in this controversy between a member of a district and a district where the member petitioned the department to cancel their water right? The department canceled their water right and then subsequently revoked that cancellation. There's been some concern that expressed that this issue may be ingrained in the motivation for this legislation. So I'm interested in where that particular process is at as far as the department is concerned right now.
Sure, Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with the case that you refer to, and I don't, if there is a relationship to this bill, I don't know about it, nor do I understand it. And in terms of the status of that case, it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that, you know, first of all, stepping back, that, as you know, the department has legal advice from the Attorney General's office that talks about how a landowner in a district can voluntarily cancel the water right appurtenant to property that they own. There are lots of people that disagree with that advice, but yet that's the advice that is currently on the table. In this situation, my understanding is that when the department issued its action to cancel the water right as requested, there was an administrative oversight in that the intent of the department's cancellation rules, as well as an agreement with the Bureau of Reclamation, is that we would, upon receiving that information, wait a minimum of 90 days and provide notice to both the district and the Bureau of Reclamation, if it was a federal Bureau of Reclamation project, to ensure that there was full and timely notice of all those that may have an interest, and I say that the term interest in a very broad way, an interest in this activity. And apparently we had failed to meet the spirit of those agreements and rules and just took a step back. And it wouldn't be the first time that the department has made a minor administrative faux pas and stepped back to correct it. That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Where is that issue at today? What is the status today?
Mr. Chair, I couldn't tell you exactly where we are in terms of that waiting period and notice, but I'd certainly be able to go back to the department and report back to you.
When did the department first get request? What was the date, you know?
I really don't know, Mr. Chair. I wasn't prepared to answer those specific questions, but I'd be happy to get you that information.
I understand you may not have been prepared to answer that. I would appreciate it if you could get me that information before the first of the week.
Sure.
On this. The questions for Adam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the kind of following up on what you were asking. So then after the 90 days had passed, after the notification to the BLM and to, or excuse me, Bureau of Land Reclamation, whatever bureau it is, and the district and all of the parties that were notified, then after that 90 days has occurred, then would you go back and, I mean, under normal circumstances, go back and issue the
the approval?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, yes.
Okay.
And it wouldn't be the first time.
Okay. It may not be the last, I don't know.
Probably not. Okay, thanks, Adam. I appreciate your coming over, and I realize that the questions may not have been, prepared for you as such. But if you can get us any answers, we have, it'd be appreciated on that.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
And, Representative, we will hold this issue over until Wednesday, I'm informed, June 1st. Though I initially said Monday, but everybody indicated they wouldn't be here on Monday, including staff. So we'll hold it till Wednesday just to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to get back from an otherwise long and medicated weekend.
They're making it sound like it's a holiday or something.
Well, I don't know. Some people apparently are taking holiday with it. And, with that, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 696 and announce that it will be heard again on June 1. I suppose we will hear from the principals, Water Resource Congress and Water for Life, on or before Wednesday, hopefully before Wednesday, as to what their positions are, and Brendan for. Just so we don't have to run another down to your office, can you just take this as a request for that amendment to be drawn up for us so that we're ready for it first of the week?
Not done, but I already have a request.
Yeah. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.